So today, I'm going to talk about the new approach to this subject due to Rob Speckens. Oh, sorry, that's the archive. paper. It's also published in the journal somewhere. So consider an ontological model. Probabilities in some operationally described experiment where you have a preparation followed by a measurement, and we're looking at the probability for outcome k. And in an ontological model, we suppose that this is given by an expression like this. So we have the probability. So if you have a given preparation, and we have a probability distribution over ontic states. And then for a given ontic state and a given measurement setting, we have the probability for a given outcome. So this is the probability that we get for this. I think this. I think you'll remember this from a previous lecture. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we will say that P and P prime are in the same equivalence class. EP, if this is true. So you may have two different preparations, but so far as probabilities are concerned, these preparations look the same. You can't distinguish them by looking at the probabilities. Now they may look different in other respects. For example, this preparation may be accomplished using a box which is blue. And this one may be accomplished using a box which is red. Or it may even be that the internal structure, what goes on inside the box, in these two cases is different. But we say they're in the same equivalence class if this is true. Now we can do something similar for measurements. If that's true. So for all preparations, we get the same probabilities for every outcome with these two measurements. So then, Speckens defines, it's good to refer to your colleagues by their surname in this way, defines, well, first of all, preparation non-contextuality. An ontological model, I guess we should say. An ontological model is preparation non-contextual if. Distributions over ontic states are equal for all preparations in the same equivalence class. And he writes, then writes this. So measurement non-contextuality is defined in the same way. For all measurements. So we have the same conditional probabilities here for all measurements in the same equivalence class. It's quite hard to write on a moving blackboard. Then he writes, that, since you only need to specify the equivalence class. So here are some notes. First note, the motivation for this is that if you have operational equivalence, things belong to the same equivalence class if they're operationally equivalent at the level of the probabilities, then you should have ontological equivalence. This is taken to be similar to sort of Max principle or even the equivalence principle in general relativity. So in general relativity, the equivalence principle, the two situations are operationally indistinguishable. You know, if you're falling and you're in free fall, you're inside an elevator, versus the case where you're just floating out in space, you can't tell the difference between those two situations. So they're taken to be ontologically equivalent in the theory. So a similar step is being made here. Okay, two. That's so number one. 0. The great thing about these definitions is that they're theory independent. The definitions I gave you previously in the Koch and Specker treatment, the standard approach, rely on objects in quantum theory. Whereas these definitions go through for any ontological model. These definitions apply not only to standard projection valued measures, where you're measuring some Hermitian operator, make a measurement corresponding to some Hermitian operator, but they also apply to generalized measurements, so apply to projection valued measurements as well. Positive operator valued measures as well as projection valued measures. And finally, these definitions do not assume outcome determinism. Remember, yesterday we made the assumption that the assigned value is simply revealed by the measurement. There's no probabilistic process in the measurement. So basically the ontic state determines the outcome of measurement. Whereas in this model, we don't need to make that assumption. So we're really getting at we're not mixing two conceptually distinct ideas. We're just getting at the idea of non-contextuality. Any questions at this stage? It's all crystal clear. Good. So, and I should say, he also introduces a third notion. So he has preparation, non-contextuality, measurement non-contextuality. He also introduces a notion of transformation non-contextuality, and it's again defined in the obvious way. You set up an equivalence class of transformations, and then you assume that you have the same ontological model for transformations that are in the same equivalence class. I'm not going to mention, write that down explicitly. So he proves lots of results. Here are two of the key results. And I'm not going to give you the proofs, just I'll just state what he proves. So preparation non-contextuality and quantum theory, or the statistics of quantum theory, leads to a contradiction. So you can't have that just means that quantum theory is not non-contextual, so it must be contextual. It must be preparation contextual. And he also proves that if you take measurement non-contextuality, and outcome determinism, and quantum theory, you get a contradiction. So this means that you can't have a non-contextual model for the measurements in quantum theory if you also have outcome determinism.
What's outcome determinism?
Oh, sorry, an outcome determinism is the property that that these probabilities are equal to 0 or 1.
How strong of an assumption is that?
Well, there's sort of an infinite number of models where it isn't true. So but it's the assumption that is also made in Koch and Specker. And so really this result is similar to the Koch and Specker result, because the Koch and Specker result is about measurements, not about preparations.
Does that definition only apply?
No, this, oh, sorry. Yes, sorry. No. Wait, actually, Annie, what's, it applies to, this applies to,
So, I guess so, because this has the square to one.
Right.
And
so,
it has to be its own square.
Yeah, but does he want the, you can still imagine with POVMs that the, no, I think you're right. This is outcome determinism for PVs. Yeah. So that's your understanding as well. That's what he assumes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. So he's not assuming anything more than the Koch and Specker result. Okay. So I'm not going to give you the actual proofs. They're relatively straightforward, and they're in that paper I mentioned at the beginning. Before I leave the topic of contextuality, I just want to ask the question about how natural this assumption is. My opinion is that it although it's interesting, it's an interesting assumption to explore. It's not a very natural assumption, and I'll illustrate this by how it works in the De Broglie-Bohm model. So clearly, the De Broglie-Bohm model has to be contextual because it's a hidden variable. It's an ontological model for quantum theory, and it's capable of reproducing quantum theory. So it has to, because of these contradictions, it has to be. It's a deterministic model as well, so it has to be contextual. So it's interesting to see how that contextuality pans out. So actually, it turns out it's more contextual than it has to be. So here's a very, I'll give you a very simple example of how it's contextual. So here's an experiment we have. Some preparation of a system, so it can be in this path or this path. Okay. So this is a different paths, some preparation. And we can think of this as the measurement. Okay. So what will happen in the De Broglie-Bohm model for this situation? So you're all experts at drawing trajectories in the De Broglie-Bohm model. So let's just think about what will happen. Well, it's very straightforward. Let's just take an example. Let's imagine the wave function is some superposition of being in these two states. And X belongs to the support of psi A. So this is a Gaussian on. So psi A, you can think of it as being some little Gaussian here. And psi B, this is a B, is a little Gaussian over here. Okay. Let's consider the case, and we have a superposition of these two things. Let's consider the case where the particle, the Broglie-Bohm particle, is actually in here. Okay, so what's going to happen? Well, is it's going to be detected here. So this one will fire. I'll go click, and this trajectory will just go straight along there. And you can think of this as corresponding to a measurement of the observable associated with the projection operator onto path A. Okay. But this is not the only way we can measure this projection operator. So like down here would have the. We can measure this same observable consisting of these two projection operators in a different way in the De Broglie-Bohm model. So here's a different way. Just take the same preparation. And now let the two paths cross. And now, well, this, if the particle is just here, if the wave function is just here, so we just have a state that's here, it's going to evolve through here. So this is associated with the projection onto A, whereas this path, this is associated with the projection onto B. Now let's imagine the same state Let's imagine the particle is originally in the same packet. It's in the A wave packet. Imagine these two have equal weight. So where's the particle going to end up? So it'll end up here because of the no crossing principle. So we can see that for two different ways of realizing the same measurement described at the level of these operators, these things are in the same equivalence class in Rob Speckens' language. We get different ontological results. This particle will go to B in one case, whereas it'll go to A in the other. So de Broglie-Bohm model is very non-contextual, if you like. The Kokenspecker or any of these theorems, none of these theorems say it would have to be this non-contextual. So it's more contextual. Very contextual. It's more contextual than it has to be. But it's also very natural that it should have this kind of contextuality. After all, although these two situations are the same at the level of probabilities, they're clearly very different in terms of their structure. This one has the paths not crossing. This one has the paths crossing. So it's a very natural kind of non-contextuality. Contextuality. And you'll find so this argument is in a paper of mine, but you'll find a similar argument by David Albert. And then you'll find a lot of arguments at this point more generally by Duer, Zanghi, and Goldstein, talking about what they think it's very unnatural to try and ascribe these sorts of non-contextual models in the context of a real ontological theory. OK. Any questions before I leave the topic of contextuality? Yep.
Is there any sense that this has been experimentally tested, like the Bell theorems have been?
So the issue of trying to test contextuality or non-contextuality it's harder than Bell's theorem because, so suddenly if you look at the original Kokenspecker theorem, it relies on having deterministic outcomes. So you perform projection valued measures. It also relies on the on quantum theory itself to state the theorem, so that makes it difficult. So people have been working on trying to come up with experiments. So Adam Cabello has done some work on that, and right now Rob Speckens and his collaborators are working on this issue. And there was a talk last week by last Tuesday. Foundations by Ravi, one of Rob's students, giving an update on progress there. It's possible that there'll be some models, but it's much harder, it turns out, to look at experiments for this, to think of inequalities and so on in this case than it is in the case of the Bell. Any more questions? Okay. So, new topic. And really, I'm moving on. I think you remember at the beginning of the course, I said there were three sort of main topic areas in this course. The first was sort of novel effects in quantum theory, and I talked about all these interferometers and so on. The second was conceptual issues, and we talked about the main interpretations and some theorems. The last part of the course is going to be about more structural issues. So I'm going to talk about generalized probability theories, attempts to reconstruct quantum theory from reasonable axioms, and reformulations of quantum theory. So let's start with generalized probability theories. So we're going to set up a general framework for probability theories applied to operational situation. And it will cover quantum theory, classical probability theory, and also potentially more general theories. So before I move on to that, I want to provide a bit of motivation or some intuition as to how this is going to pan out in the case of quantum theory. So remember, that a density matrix like this is equivalent
consider an experiment where we prepare some state, rho, and then we make a measurement. Corresponding to some positive, with an outcome corresponding to some positive operator. Then the probability is given in quantum theory by the trace of rho. Yeah. A. So this is the state. And this is the positive operator associated with the outcome. We would have done that in Joe's course. But since this relationship is linear, we must be able to write this down as a dot product. So does this these two things are linearly related, and taking the trace of rho times A is just a this is basically just a linear map on rho, turning over a real number. So this is just a linear function on rho. So it has to be written in this form. So just as you can determine this p vector from the state, likewise you can determine some r vector from the positive operator associated with the measurement outcome. Is that obvious? The one thing that's interesting here is that you only need, for the case of a
spin half particle qubit, you only need four probabilities. And using those four probabilities, you can calculate all the other probabilities. So any other measurement you might make on the spin half particle, you can determine the probability for that just by some appropriate linear function like this, using only those four probabilities. So you can think of this as funny. You can say, well, I could have a long list of all the different probabilities I could measure. So there's all the different things I could measure. But the state is given by only specifying four of them. So you can kind of you can compress down to a an object that has only four. And this compression is linear, and then you can go back again in the other direction, as long as you know the R vector associated with the particular alpha. So what's nice about this way of doing things versus this way is that this is not theory specific. So this is clearly very theory specific if you use objects that appear in the quantum theory. Whereas this way of working is capable of accommodating more general probabilistic theories. So this seems like a better place to start. So I'm going to start with circuit description. So I'll explain what I mean by circuits and brackets. So I'm interested in circuits. And circuits are made by wiring together operations.
Hi. In general, these probability vectors, what kind of size would they be if you had like a general n-dimensional hilbert?
Yeah, so I'll come to that. So, but the short answer is, in quantum theory, when you have an n-dimensional hilbert space, the vectors are size n squared. This turns out to be very helpful. So here's a, this is an operation. So this is meant to correspond to some part of an experiment that you might perform in a laboratory. So maybe you know you have a laser or a lens or detector or some other thing. And we're going to think of it as having inputs and outputs. Like so. And in addition to that, I want to associate a set of let's just imagine we have some box in the laboratory. Boxes in the laboratory. Sometimes they're just boxes, but sometimes they're more complicated. So it has inputs and outputs. The outputs correspond to some apertures, as do the inputs. So you have apertures at the top, apertures at the bottom. Really, these are just holes in the box, or places where you might attempt to send a system in and have a system come out. When we talk about this box as being an operation, what we're doing is we're identifying some of these apertures as corresponding to inputs, and some of these apertures as corresponding to outputs. That's a choice that we made that sort of limits how we intend to use this box in performing experiments. In addition, this box may have on it some knobs that you can set in different ways. And it may also have on it some sort of meters or lights that flash. And in specifying an operation, we're going to restrict ourselves. So this symbol A is going to restrict itself to a particular set of outcomes. So we have many possible outcomes here. You could say, well, one outcome is where this light flashes, this one doesn't, and this needle is pointed at another four. Another outcome would be something else. So you can enumerate all the possible outcomes on this box. And now, a particular operation has associated with it a restricted set of outcomes. Set of outcomes that may be less than all the outcomes. Generally, this is a subset of the set of all outcomes. Okay. Does that make sense? So you can think of an operation as an event. So what happens? You'll say the operation has happened if the outcome that you see is in the set of outcomes associated with the operation.
question. Does this assume that different operations correspond to disjoint sets of outcomes?
So if you want to have a set of operations that sort of cover, so you have a given box with given knob settings, and you want to have a set of operations that cover all the outcomes, then they would correspond to ones having disjoint sets of outcomes, whose union is the set of all outcomes. Of course, you might also want to consider just two operations that don't have disjoint sets of outcomes. But, suddenly, if you want them to, you want to have what I call a complete set of operations, then they have to correspond to disjoint sets of outcomes, which cover
all sets. I guess my concern is that if you see a certain outcome that's in, it could be in two different sets associated with two different operators. There's ambiguity in saying which operation.
So what we're going to be interested in is calculating probabilities for circuits. So you write down the circuit, on probabilities for circuits. Okay, and that's a well-defined question. So I'll come to that. So it is a circuit. So circuit is when you wire together a bunch of operations and you have no open inputs or outputs left over. These different inputs and outputs have type labels associated with them because we're thinking of them as corresponding to different types of system. So A may correspond to an electron, B may correspond to a photon, and so on. When we join things together, we want to do type matching so that this is an electron output, we want to send it into an electron input. Of course, we don't have to do that, but things might go wrong if we don't. So if we have something like this, where this was an output for small rocks, and this was an input for photons, and we send the small rock over here, then it's likely that these small rocks will damage this device. So what? I mean, one could still do that experiment. There's nothing to stop you sending small rocks into there. So I think there's sort of a criticism of the operational approach here, which is that it requires you to restrict the experiments you consider. So these are the diagrams. I also want to introduce some symbolic notation. There's some symbolic notation. And so you'll see that the subscripts correspond to inputs. You see here we have an input of type A and one of type B. And the superscripts correspond to outputs. And I've also introduced these integer labels. I'll explain the reason for that. over here we have a circuit, and here I describe the circuit in diagrammatic language, but we can also describe it in symbolic language. So far that's no good because I don't know which wire is which. So here I have one wire going from A to B. And I'm going to just use a label for that wire. Let's just call it 1. And now this one goes from B to D. Let's call that 2. And so on. And now we have a symbolic description of this same circuit.
So what do the numbers mean? Different?
They're just labels. You could change them. Yeah, I could change this. Rather than using 1, I could use the number 52. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. So the meaning of this expression is the same if you change the labels.
What's the difference between the numerical and the alphabetic
the
labels?
Yeah. So
there,
the number tells you which wire,
yeah.
whereas the symbol tells you the type of system. Maybe it would have been better actually if I'd done had an example like this. Let's do that. Okay. So let's see. I've changed C to A. So you can see you have two instances of a system of type A. It could be an electron. The same symbol both times. But you need to give them different integer labels over here. Over here, you don't need the integer labels because you can just see where the wires are. So in the diagram, you don't need it, but in this description, you do. So a few points here. We're going to consider circuits which don't have systems going back in time. So if we trace from output to input, we can never get back to where we started. Point one. Point two, the content of this diagram is just graphical. So if I distort it, for example, if I move this over here, it's the same, corresponds to the same physical situation. So the physical meaning of this graph is, this diagram is purely graphical. As long as I don't change inputs to outputs, as long as I keep the graphical content of this graph as it is, keep the orientation so that the bottom of the top stays at the bottom and the top stays at the top, then we have the same physical situation. Over here, there's a similar statement, which is that I can shuffle around these letters, so I could have instead put this at the end. Has the same meaning. Back. You're going to put it down here. Normally we write symbols in a row, but you don't have to. Has the same meaning. So, because the point is that this expression tells you how the wires are connected, and just in the same way this graph does. Another point is a circuit can't have disconnected parts, so I could have two parts to my circuit that aren't connected to each other. Here's an example of a fragment. So a fragment is a bunch of operations that are wired together, but where you have some open inputs and outputs left over. There's two special kinds of fragments. A preparation is where we have just open outputs. I'm going to call it a result. It is a preparation, is a fragment, having only open inputs. Example of a preparation would be this. An example of a result. So what I'm going to do next, and I think I'll leave this till tomorrow, is I'm going to talk about how you put probabilities onto this circuit, onto this sort of object. This seems like a good point to bring.
Isn't this vice versa? A result is a fragment having only open
input. Did I say? Yeah.
It looks like output. No?
Which this way?
A result.
The things at the bottom are inputs.
Inputs.
Yeah. So inputs are the ones at the bottom. So because I'm an optimist, I have time going up. Optimists have time going down, and people who think that progress goes
right. No. I think that the result is associated with output.
So the result is, if you have a set of results corresponding to disjoint outcome sets, that would constitute a measurement.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you.